Today's macroeconomic news brought to you by six letters of the alphabet, U, A, and W, the United Auto Workers, and O, I, and L, which is oil. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 16th day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Well, that was quite a weekend, wasn't it? 5% of the world's daily oil production taken violently offline. Almost 50,000 members of the United Auto Workers taking General Motors offline after their contract lapsed. We'll do oil first, I guess, just because. Both the U.S. benchmark, West Texas Intermediate, it's called, and the global indicator known as Brent Crude ended the day up just shy of 15%. But here's the deal. There is plenty of oil on the shelves, as it were. Saudi Arabia's got some. The U.S. and other countries have their own reserves. There is supply to meet demand. Those higher prices then reflect something that maybe we ought to get used to talking about in global energy markets, something called the risk premium. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us going.
To some analysts, oil buyers and sellers have been kind of asleep to energy risks in the Middle East. In the past month, tankers were attacked and pipelines were struck. Not much reaction until Saturday's strike on Saudi Arabia, says Halima Croft at RBC Capital Markets.
The market was very complacent about the degree of risk in this standoff involving Iran and U.S. allies in the region. Now, I almost cannot say how serious this is.
Saturday's apparently surgical strike on this essential artery creates one of the biggest disruptions ever to world supply. Jean-Francois Sesnek at the Atlantic Council think tank says the attack warns oil markets that whoever targeted this fortified facility could hit it again.
It has three different rings of defense, and Al-Qaeda never managed to pass the first one. I would imagine, and that's the big surprise, is that they would be protected by Patriot missiles, and they have not.
Another risk is how long the Saudi facility stays offline. For the next 3 or 4 weeks, there's plenty in reserve. But for a world that drinks 100 million barrels of oil every day, that cushion could go quickly, says Jacques Rousseau at Clearview Energy Partners.
You know, if this starts to drag into next year, the world will have taken down their inventories very substantially.
If world supply is still short then, oil and pump prices could double by some estimates. And that's the new risk built into the higher price of oil, what some call the Gulf Premium. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The global oil market's about as big a big picture story as you can get, right? So is the biggest American car maker not being able to come to terms with its biggest union, now that you mention it. But at least for that story, there is an easy way to make it personal. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson spent the summer in Ohio, Michigan, and Maryland talking to workers at three plants that GM has decided to take offline about the choice they were offered. Stay with GM, even if it means picking up and moving, or doing something else. With the strike now in day one, we asked Tracy to get him back on the phone.
Lewis Phipps Jr. logged 20,000 steps on the picket line this morning in front of GM's idle transmission plant outside Baltimore. He's one of only 7 people still working there. And he says when he got the text message yesterday about the strike,
yeah, I said, yeah, let's do it. The people up there in them big offices, they're getting their money. The CEOs, the vice presidents, and all of them, they're getting paid big dollars. We down here, we getting little pennies compared to them.
Like many GM workers, Phipps feels like GM's employees helped the company through the financial crisis. And now that it's doing better, they should share in that. In the meantime, they'll have to make do with only $250 a week from the union while they're on strike. Mike Greason, who works at GM's Toledo plant, says he always makes sure his finances are in order when the UAW contract comes up for renewal every 4 years.
I give myself a year and a half to pay off all my bills. I don't want no bills when we go on strike.
Greason's wife also works for GM, so both of them are taking a hit.
You can't think the auto industry is like guaranteed to be there for you. You have to prepare yourself. They pay you good wages. You prepare yourself for any situation that happens.
GM says it offered the union $7 billion in new investments as part of these negotiations, plus solutions for the plants in Ohio and Michigan that it's idling, though it didn't explain what those solutions would be.
Obviously, I'm leery when they say they offer a solution.
Dave Green was president of the UAW local in Lordstown, Ohio, until he transferred to GM's Bedford, Indiana plant last month.
I live in a new area now, right? But I'm not going to buy a residency here until I understand what's in this contract.
No matter what happens, he says he's now committed to Indiana. Any solution for his old plant in Lordstown would be too late for him. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I mean, honestly, could have been so much worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So what do you think? The GM strike and the oil thing. This week's signs that the apocalypse is upon us, or just another day in the global economy? Context being pretty much everything, we've gotten Roberto Perli on the phone. He's a partner at the economic policy research firm Cornerstone Macro. Ms. Perli, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we have the news from Scott Tong about oil. We have Tracy Samuelson talking about General Motors. As you look at the last, 24 hours in the global economy, are you thinking bad thoughts or are you thinking, not so bad?
Well, look, I think there is no doubt that oil prices are up a lot. But there's also no doubt that the U.S. economy is very resilient, is in a very good shape. In fact, the U.S. economy is in the best shape of any other advanced economies, and actually probably better shape than most other emerging economies. So we're starting from a very good starting point. So I wouldn't assume that just because oil prices went up even a lot today, it's not necessarily a sign that we're going into recession.
Okay, the American economy is strong, I grant you that, but oil is globally traded and everybody's paying more, right?
Well, absolutely, right. So, but I would also remember that in the past, we had oil prices quite a bit higher than today without a recession. That's the first observation. The second observation is that the U.S. economy today is different than what it was 10 or 20 years ago. Hmm. Back then, we used to import virtually all the oil that we used. And now, actually, we don't, right? We produce a lot of oil domestically. And I think that's going to help us. It's not obvious that manufacturers are going to fire everybody just because oil prices are higher.
Right. Let's say this oil shock goes on for 30 days. What are you going to start looking at to gauge whether it's really digging in?
Well, I think the first thing that we need to look at is jobless claims. So what's that? That's the number of people that lose jobs every week and that claim unemployment, right? So if we see those numbers going up, that means that firms, businesses are actually firing people, and that's not a good sign. But the good news is that so far we haven't seen anything of the sort, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously oil prices just started going up now, but we're starting again from a very strong point. Jobless claims are at or near record lows.
You used to work at the Federal Reserve, right?
I did, yes.
Okay. So with the insider's knowledge that you have, obviously Mr. Powell and the gang are meeting this week. Is this changing their calculations at all, do you think?
Well, I think it's too early, right? So like everybody, obviously they're watching the situation. They're monitoring oil prices very carefully. They're monitoring jobless claims, as we just said. But I don't think they are panicking, right? Again, because the U.S. economy starts from a very good starting position. So I think their attitude would be, let's see what happens. If something bad happens, of course, we're going to cut rates. We're going to do what we can to cushion the economy from this shock. But there is no need to do anything drastic at the moment. So they're vigilant, but I don't think they're panicking.
Roberto Perli, formerly of the Federal Reserve, now a partner at Cornerstone Macro. That's an economic policy shop. Mr. Perli, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
There are a couple of more points to make about that oil story today. First of all, there is the small matter of what was once expected to be the biggest initial stock offering Wall Street had ever seen, Saudi Aramco, the Saudi National Oil Company. Drone attacks, conventional wisdom goes, are not good news on the initial public offering front. Samantha Gross is a foreign policy fellow at Brookings. She studies energy security there.
And this absolutely increases the risk premium and the impression of risk associated with that IPO.
Risk premium. Where have we heard that before today, huh? Of course, it is also helpful to remember why Saudi Aramco wants to go public in the first place.
Well, the Saudis want the Aramco IPO because they're basically cashing in some of the family jewels. They want to sell 5% of Aramco and offer it publicly so that they can then take that money and roll it into other parts of the Saudi economy.
The first rule of good financial management, right? Diversify. So while this IPO will eventually be a big deal for Saudi Arabia, for the rest of the world, here's Samantha Gross at Brookings one more time.
I think it affects the rest of the world more through a lens of general energy security and whether Saudi supplies are sort of the rock of energy security that we've all assumed for all these years.
All right, one last thing on this, and then we'll move on, I promise. But this is a really big deal. Here's Ed Herz at the University of Houston.
China buys 10 to 11 million barrels a day.
Which is to say, China is really dependent on foreign crude imports. Not great when you factor in an already slowing economy. And, oh, by the way, a trade war.
Spending a lot more on this at a period of time when Chinese growth is slowing would be a further drag on the national Chinese economy and could make it more difficult for the Chinese leadership.
Ed Herz at the University of Houston wrapping things up for us. Crude once again today in both of its varieties, West Texas and Brent North Sea, up about 15%. While there are surely more investigations and studies to be done, these seem like very bad days for the vaping industry. Hundreds of people have gotten sick. Some have died from lung disease linked to the use of its product as directed. The Trump administration says it's cracking down on flavored e-cigarettes. Marketing to teens is getting a close once over as well, which means with every headline, the pressure grows on Juul, maybe the best known of the big vaping companies. So it's looking for scientists to look into the health effects of its products. Not a whole lot of takers on those offers, and the few who have taken are getting some blowback, as Blake Farmer reports now from WPLN in Nashville.
Scientists around the country have reported being approached formally and informally by Juul Labs. Stan Glantz at the University of California, San Francisco is one of them.
Well, the pitch is, you know, we're a revolutionary new company and we're trying to reduce the harm of smoking and we need researchers. Are you interested in working with us? And we have loads of money.
Glantz, who specializes in tobacco control, says he would never even consider it.
No, I mean, I know the history here. I mean, I've written a book about the history of how the tobacco industry manipulates science.
Juul doesn't sell tobacco, but Altria, the maker of Marlboro, now owns a stake in the company. This summer, Juul did announce its first university research partner. It's giving $7.5 million to fund work at Meharry Medical College, a historically black institution in Nashville. It's the second largest research grant in the school's history. Senior Vice President Patrick Johnson says he sees it as a rare opportunity for African-American scientists to lead cutting-edge discovery on a swift-moving societal phenomenon.
We have always or traditionally been at the back end of those experiments. It is important that we have been called to be at the forefront of this research, not on the back end.
If vaping causes health problems, Johnson says he wants to know sooner rather than later. And if it's safer than cigarettes, he'd want to know that too, since smoking disproportionately kills black people. He says that the school's research will remain absolutely independent, with no input from Juul about what's studied and what gets published. But the school began taking heat from around the country almost immediately.
We knew that it was a leap of faith. We knew that there would be detractors.
Among those who questioned Meharry's decision, the tobacco control leader of Nashville's public health department.
I just want to say that, you know, if you put lipstick on a pig, it's still a pig.
Lillian Maddox-Whitehead addressed a town hall meeting held recently on Meharry's campus and organized by black public health activists. To date, vaping has generally been seen as popular among white teens, but in her audits of corner stores, Maddox-Whitehead says she's seen vaping companies pushing their products in black neighborhoods. She fears a repeat of how cigarette companies pushed menthols to African Americans.
I would just encourage people to realize that this is a problem and it will become a problem in our community. It may not be a problem now, but I do see it coming.
Some national public health leaders have called on Meharry to even consider giving the money back. But third-year dental student Corinthia Wilkerson said the science is badly needed.
Why is there so much resistance towards Meharry for wanting to be leaders at the forefront of this research?
Jewel turned down Marketplace for an interview, but CEO Kevin Burns did talk to CBS this morning in late August, and he said the company recognizes it has an uphill battle in the scientific community, especially given its links to the tobacco industry.
Our job is to create the right kind of protocols, do the right kind of tests, publish the right kind of research, make sure it's peer-reviewed, deliver it in a transparent fashion, and over time, hopefully build some credibility in terms of that. It's going to take a while, though, to build that credibility.
Without some reliable research, the company may not have a product to sell. Juul is still seeking approval from the Food and Drug Administration and has a deadline of May next year. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They were charging $2 to shoot four ears.
Ears of corn, people. Ears of corn. Come on. But first, let's do the numbers. Once again, could have been so very much worse. Dow Industrials off 142 points, about a half percent, 27,076. The NASDAQ down 23 points, a bit more than a quarter percent, 81.53. The S&P 500 down 9 points, 0.3%. 29.97. Airline stocks slumped with the anticipation of higher fuel costs. United Airlines decelerated more than 2.5%. Delta landed down 1.5%. Alaska off 1.8%. Retailers declined as well. Amazon, which relies on deliveries, which rely on gas, right, down 1.7%. Walmart gave back about 1.5% today. Oil and gas producers revved up. Marathon Oil, based in Houston, Texas, up 11.5%. Devon Energy gushed up more than 12%. The big multinationals saw more modest gains. ExxonMobil found about 1.5%. Royal Dutch Shell up 2.5%. Workers on strike against General Motors. GM shares down 4.2%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The big deal about the attack on those Saudi oil facilities is that Saudi Arabia is the global backstop. They're the ones with the extra capacity that can be brought online reasonably quickly. We don't know how long the installations bomb this weekend are going to be offline, but here's the thought. Saudi Arabia is the biggest oil exporter, but the United States is the world's biggest producer. So what about us? Can America's oil infrastructure fill the global gap? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
The U.S. exports about 3 million barrels of oil a day. To crank out a lot more than that would take some time. Jamie Webster is a senior director at Boston Consulting Group.
It would take, 6 to 12 months before you would really see a substantial increase in U.S. production.
That's because you couldn't just get that much more oil out of existing wells. Oil producers would have to find new places to drill and set up the sites.
And then, of course, this needs to be hooked up to a pipeline of some sort to then connect it into the global system.
Tom Seng, who directs the School of Energy at the University of Tulsa, says the U.S. is already short on pipelines.
The last time I looked, there are some 8,000 wells in the United States that have been drilled, but they're waiting on infrastructure before they can actually flow.
President Trump says he's told federal agencies to speed up approvals for new pipelines. He's also authorized his administration to release oil from U.S. strategic reserves. And oil companies have their own reserves that they could sell globally.
From a pure quantity of oil standpoint, certainly, yes, we could do this. We just don't have the exporting infrastructure in place.
One problem? The water in our major shipping channels is kind of shallow, and the really big oil tankers hit the bottom.
A very large crude carrier can carry like 3 million barrels. It could get into the ship channel, but as soon as you fill it up, it's stuck. It can't get back out.
Infrastructure problems are one reason the U.S., despite being the world's biggest oil producer, is not its biggest exporter. But the International Energy Agency predicts that could change. It says with the pipelines and renovations in the works, the U.S. could close in on Saudi Arabia within the next 5 years. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. Now for something completely different. I saw a piece in the Wall Street Journal the other day about how farmers who are dealing with the trade war and low crop prices are trying to find an edge with something called agritainment. Corn mazes, yes, pumpkin patches too. Also, produce as projectiles, corn shooting out of air cannons. Adam Thompson wrote it. He's a writer and editor at the Journal. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
How did you get turned on to this story, man?
I was on a bike ride in the middle of Iowa, actually, strangely enough.
And you saw somebody shooting corn out of a cannon?
Yeah. There's a seven-day bike ride called Rag Bride runs across the entire state. I had been meaning to do it for years. I finally did one day this year. On that one day, on the stop for lunch, we stopped at a place called Howell's Farm, and they had everything there. They were amazing. They had goat yoga and hay rides and everything. And then also I saw people shooting corn out of a cannon.
All right, so
a giant target between two silos.
We'll get back to the goat yoga in a minute, but it's literally people taking corn, shoving it down a pneumatic cannon-looking thing, and shooting it, right? That's
exactly
the deal? Okay.
That's the deal. It's nothing more complicated than taking gun and firing it into the sky.
Are these farmers trying to get creative at a time when, you know, produce prices are down and there's a trade war and you know, things are tough and you gotta make money where you can?
Yeah, I think it's a hedge, basically. I think you're not going to save the farm with a food cannon, but it's getting people to come to the farm to have fun. Then when they're there, they might buy more than they would have otherwise. I think it's not necessarily a loss leader, because I think some of these things could actually make money, but it's something that they feel like they need to do to sort of take the edge off when crops aren't looking good or prices are low.
I imagine that, you know, I can go to my local Piggly Wiggly and get probably 4 years of corn for like $2. There's probably some kind of premium at a shooting range, as it were.
Well, the place where I was, they were charging $2 to shoot 4 ears. Uh-huh. And the person who runs it, Fred Howell, I talked to him later, and he said that corn selling for about $3.50 or $4 a bushel right now, and by his own back of the napkin calculations, he's getting about $100 a bushel for the corn that he's using as ammunition.
Ah, good for him. Okay, so to the goat yoga then. What is that?
Goat yoga is exactly what it sounds like. Goat yoga is people doing yoga with goats, sometimes standing on them. The goats standing on the people, not the other way around.
did you see this?
I did.
How much does a session of goat yoga cost you?
I wasn't paying as much attention because the corn cannon caught my eye, but I think it can be done very affordably.
I'm sure it can. All right, now back to the cannons and stuff. There's actually an industry that builds these cannons and sells them at not cheap prices.
No, you can get these things, but they're $5,000-$6,000, and you know they're not huge sellers, but they sell steadily every year. And there are other farmers who think they can build them themselves, some of those. I think the one in Iowa was self-built also, but there are plenty of people who are buying these things, and I talked to a farm in North Carolina that had bought two, and the waits were so long for them that they just bought a third one for the big season this fall.
Adam Thompson, he's a writer, also a reporter, and an editor at the Wall Street Journal. Adam, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
This final note on the way out today, in which if you can read French, if you have friends who live over there, and if you have the time and willpower to wade through 1,232 pages of economic theory, well, we've got a late summer reading recommendation for you. Perhaps you've heard of Thomas Piketty, the French economist whose 2013 book, Capital in the 21st Century, sold 2 million copies. 2 million copies of that thing? Anyway, he's got a sequel out this week in the original French, English translation coming this spring. Capital and Ideology, it's called. And among its policy prescriptions, employees should have 50% of the seats on company boards, and that the voting power of any shareholder should be capped at 10%. Going to hit right as the presidential campaign gets going. That's all I'm saying. All right, I'm pretty sure that's all we've got. The Dow Industrial's off 142 points today, about a half percent. No, I'm completely sure that's all we've got. The NASDAQ down 23 points, more than a quarter percent. The S&P 500 fell 9 points, 0.3%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Liza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.